Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Congress.
Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, members of the 85th Congress.
Mr. Speaker, members of the 88th Congress, I congratulate you all.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of the House, members of the Senate, my fellow Americans.
The Congress of the United States, the Senate, the House of Representatives, 535 men and women. The most powerful legislative body in the world, its history is nothing less than the history of America. For nearly 200 years, the voices of Congress have mirrored the best in our nation, and at times, something less than that too. For above all, the Congress is a representative institution. Today, the United States Congress is big, powerful, firmly established, like the nation it represents. In 1789, when Congress first met, it also represented the nation. But the nation was new, and the precise form of government outlined by the Constitution was untried. Congress found that it must establish even the simplest of practices, for there were no precedents to fall back upon. The nation's first vice president, John Adams, asked his colleagues for advice as he presided over the first session of the United States Senate.
Gentlemen, I wish for direction of the Senate. The President will, I expect, address the Congress. How shall I behave? How shall we receive it? Shall it be standing or sitting?
It is only right that we stand.
We shall sit. Are we not all equal?
In England, the House of Lords sits and the Commons stands when the King addresses them.
Mr. Adams, how say you?
If he comes, we must have a seat for him. In England, it is called a throne.
I think it is of no consequence how it is in England. They are no rule to us. It is only proper that we have a seat with a canopy for the president.
Fisher Ames, congressman from Massachusetts in the new House of Representatives.
When Congress first met, the government of a great nation had barely revenue enough to buy stationery for its clerks or pay the salary of a doorkeeper. Yet endless time was spent in debates upon form in the House and in the Senate. We had no presidents to guide us. There were many among us who, although they would not admit it, preferred a monarchy to a republic. Some of the senators felt very strongly.
Certainly General Washington must have a title. In all the world, civilized and savage, men call their leaders by titles.
Let us call him Excellency.
I am in favor of Highness. It is a title used by the Grand Turk and all the princes of Germany. Surely it is appropriate.
Surely there is nothing more noble than president.
But president alone? Why, there are presidents of fire companies and cricket clubs.
Elective Majesty seems most fitting.
Some states have authorized titles by their constitutions.
Connecticut has done so.
I stood many times in the House of Representatives and pointed out that the Constitution prohibited granting titles of nobility. But the Senate would follow its own line of reasoning.
Report of the Special Committee on Titles. We favor the following title: His Highness the President of the United States of America and Protector of the Rights of the same.
Bravo! Excellent! Excellent! Very good.
Finally, it was resolved. The Senate was in favor of titles, but the House, being composed of very good men, not shining, but honest and reasonably well-informed, was against it. Rather than divide ourselves so soon, we determined to address the President without title. But, oh, this business of government could make a man sore. 4 days in a stagecoach just to get from Boston to New York. The horses are shifted, but the poor traveler is kept harnessed. And they talk of moving the capital yet further south.
Philadelphia is a likely spot with good lodgings and fine taverns.
I bring forward the great and glorious falls of the Delaware.
Why not Harrisburg, Pennsylvania?
I'm in favor of Trenton.
The capital should be along the Potomac.
There's nothing there but mud.
Germantown. I care little where Congress may sit. I would not find fault with Fort Pitt if we could proceed in peace and quietness. How it will be resolved, I know not.
Mr. Speaker, it is proposed here in the House of Representatives that the seat of government be moved to Philadelphia for a period of 10 years, thence to the banks of the Potomac River near a settlement called Georgetown. And there we will build a
The city of Washington, almost in the center of the new nation, was to be built as the national capital. And the early Congresses moved to establish other precedents, too, to build the nation's government and to attend to the business of the day. Some early members of Congress predicted that a spirit of eternal harmony would settle over their debates. But this proved to be a myth. The country was growing. Americans had differences of opinion, and inevitably, Congress reflected them. Economic conflict, sectional rivalry. A New England congressman implies that his colleagues from other parts of the country are barbarians.
New England is of all colonies that were ever founded the most respectable and prosperous, the most truly interesting to America and to humanity. Our society is of the best sort rather than the largest size, as superior to other people as the old Roman race to its neighbors and competitors.
William McClay, first United States Senator from Pennsylvania.
I have had full opportunity of observing the gentlemen of New England in the Senate chamber. And sorry indeed am I to say it, but no people in the Union dwell more on trivial distinctions and matters of mere form. They have stiffened airs and consider sentiment a quality too vulgar for gentlemen. I may as well minute a remark here as anywhere else. We really have more Republican plainness and sincere openness of behavior in Pennsylvania than in any other place I have ever been.
Soon the nation's first political parties coalesced. Representative Fisher Ames was a Federalist.
Instead of feeling as a nation, a state is our country. We look often with hatred, fear, and aversion to the other states. It displeases me. I wish to have every American think the Union so indissoluble and integral that corn would not grow nor the pot boil if it should be broken. We must have a strong central government. That is what the Federalist Party stands for.
Are not the people the government? Their party is the Democratic Republican Party. Some of us in Congress will not grant so much power to the central government. We must fight the Federalists, and we must look to the election of Mr. Jefferson as president.
The mock Republican leaders, as they affect to call themselves, address their words to the vicious and violent rabble. If Americans follow them, we shall lose our liberty.
Surely Jefferson will win.
He's got the people behind him.
Vote for Jefferson.
I see almost no chance of preventing the election of Mr. Jefferson. Few dread as they ought the evils of American democracy.
Jefferson can win. Vote for Jefferson.
Jefferson. Rejoice, Columbia sons. Rejoice to tyrants. Never bend the knee. Join with heart, with soul, and voice. For Jefferson and liberty.
The President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson.
Friends and fellow citizens, let us bear in mind that every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. Let us then, fellow citizens, unite with one heart and one mind. I see a rising nation spread over a wide and fruitful land, advancing rapidly to destinies beyond the reach of mortal eye.
While the Federalist Party was writing tracts against the common man was politicking his way into power, led by Thomas Jefferson, the Republicans, and the new men of the South and West. The nation of George Washington, John Adams, and the insular voices of the New Englanders was passing. In the Congress, voices of a new, broader America were heard, eyes turned westward toward new lands and frontiers.
Members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, the property and sovereignty of all the Louisiana Territory have been transferred to the United States.
Why, he's all but double the size of the country.
1803.
The representatives from the new state of Ohio are proud to take their seats in the Congress.
Come along, you brisk young fellows who have a mind to roam, all in some foreign country, a long way from home. All in some foreign country, along with me to go. We'll settle on the banks of the lovely Ohio. We'll settle on the banks of the lovely Ohio.
1812.
Louisiana is pleased to become one of the great states of the United States and to send elected representatives to the Congress in Washington.
1816.
As senator from the newly admitted state of Indiana, I acknowledge that we are new Americans who are even now settling the wilderness. But you will hear from us.
1818.
Illinois joins the Union and takes her place in the Congress of the United States.
Way down upon the Wabash, such land was never known. If Adam had passed over it, the soil he'd surely own. He'd think it was the garden he played in when a boy, and straight pronounce it Eden in the state of Illinois. Then move your family westward, good health you will enjoy, and rise to wealth and honor in the state of Illinois.
1820.
The people of Missouri desire to join the Union.
Responsible members of Congress will not permit slavery in the new state of Missouri. Though it threatens to split the very heart of Congress, I shall oppose Missouri's admission as a slave state.
Missouri has every right to maintain slavery.
The House will not admit Missouri unless she promises emancipation.
Now that is a matter of...
Cannot let us hear slavery. Congress will not
admit Missouri. Former President Jefferson.
The momentous slavery question, like a fire bell in the night, awakened and filled me with terror. I considered it at once as the knell of the Union. When I reflect that God is just, I tremble for my country. His justice cannot sleep forever.
It was finally settled by a compromise. Maine entering as a free state, Missouri retaining slavery. I became Missouri's first senator.
Thomas Hart Benton.
The cry against slavery then seemed to me like the cry of wolf. I had other things to think about. When I got to Washington in 1821, I met many Western members of Congress, all ardent men of strong feelings. We wanted to turn the nation's attention westward.
The bill before the Senate would authorize the occupation of the Columbia River in the Oregon Territory and regulate trade with the Indians thereon. The fur trade, the Asiatic trade, and the preservation of our own territory are among the advantages.
They want us to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to develop Indian territory.
Members of Congress from the new states, we must continue our exertions, though some laugh at us. We shall develop the West. We shall insist that the government give public land to those who would settle and cultivate it. Why, even in the Bible, the promised land was divided freely among the children of Israel. Only our government tries to sell land to its citizens. We shall fight for the common people, and the common people will win.
The voices inside Congress reflected the voices of the nation at large. America was becoming more democratic. In 1828, the common people elected a folk hero president, then poured by the thousands into Washington to see Andrew Jackson inaugurated.
It was like Rome being invaded by the barbarians. Never can I forget the electrifying moment when the eager eyes of that vast and motley multitude caught sight of the tall and imposing form of their adored leader. All hats were off at once, and 10,000 upturned, exultant faces were radiant with sudden joy. After the ceremony, everyone rushed to the White House to partake of the orange punch and touch the hand of the great man. They stood in muddy boots on the satin-covered furniture. Never did I see such a mixture. the reign of King Mob seemed triumphant.
Muted by the noise of Jackson's victory was the fire bell in the night, the slavery question. But in the coming years, it refused to be silenced. And as the nation cracked in two, so did that mirror of the nation, Congress. In the Senate chamber...
Senator Hayne from South Carolina.
I asked the gentleman from Massachusetts, suppose Congress should pass a law emancipating our slaves or commit any other violations of our constitutional rights. Will any gentleman contend that the decision of the federal government in favor of such laws could prevent the states from declaring them null and void?
Senator Daniel Webster of Massachusetts.
Sir, if there is no power to settle such questions, is not the Union a rope of sand? When my eyes shall be turned to behold for the last time the sun in heaven, may I not see him shining on the broken and dishonored fragments of a once glorious Union? Let their last feeble glance rather behold the ensign of the Republic, spread all over in characters of living light and blazing on its ample folds that sentiment dear to every true American heart. Liberty and Union, now and forever, one and inseparable.
The Union was saved by congressional compromise. But John C. Calhoun from South Carolina warned his fellow countrymen from the floor of the Senate.
Is it not certain that if something is not done to arrest it, the South will be forced to choose between abolition and secession? Indeed, as events are now moving, it will not require the South to secede in order to dissolve the Union. The cry of Union, Union, the glorious Union, can no more prevent this Union than the cry of health, health, glorious health on the part of the physician can save a patient lying dangerously ill. How can the Union be saved? There is but one way: by adopting such measures as will satisfy the Southern section that they can remain in the Union consistently with their honor.
5 years before it erupted in the nation, violence broke out in the Senate.
Order, gentlemen. The chair recognizes the senator from Massachusetts.
Mr. President, members of the Senate, I wish to address myself today to the senator from South Carolina. He overflows with rage, with incoherent phrases. Were the whole history of South Carolina blotted out of existence, civilization would lose little.
That is absolutely enough. I declare it.
May 22nd, 1856, special to the New York Herald. About 1:30, after the Senate adjourned, Senator Sumner, who had spoken these words, was sitting in his seat. Representative Preston Brooks, congressman from South Carolina, and nephew of Senator Butler, the target of Sumner's remarks, approached him.
Mr. Sumner, I have read your speech against South Carolina, in which you have libeled my state and slandered my white-haired old relative, Senator Butler, and I have come to punish you for it.
We're saying, Brooks began beating Sumner with his walking cane about the head, driving him onto the floor.
I'm almost dead. Almost dead.
Go to it, Brooks!
Get up, Brooks!
Give the abolitionist hell! Let him alone! Let him alone!
Violence reigns in the streets of Washington. Violence has now found its way into the Senate chamber.
Disunion rather than dishonor!
The crimes this land is guilty of will not be purged except by blood!
You indicate war, sir! Please, order! Order, please!
Mr. President, I yield on behalf of my colleague, the senator from Mississippi, Jefferson Davis,
to
Today, January 21st, 1861, I rise for the last time in this chamber. I rise for the purpose of announcing that the state of Mississippi has declared her separation from the United States. Under these circumstances, of course, my functions are terminated here. I am sure there is not one of you, whatever sharp discussions there may have been between us, to whom I cannot say, in the presence of God, I wish you well.
The newly elected President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln.
Fellow citizens of the Senate and the House of Representatives, the war continues. The last ray of hope for preserving the Union expired at the assault upon Fort Sumter. Gentlemen, we cannot escape history. We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope on earth. The way is plain. The task toward peace is clear. I ask your help.